This is Taking Care in Business, a podcast that dives into the topic of corporate social responsibility from many different perspectives. Host Vicki Bolson is the founder and CEO of Bolson Group, a unified marketing company located in Indianapolis. Bolson Group is the first B Corp certified company in Indiana, but Vicki understands that you don't have to be certified in corporate social responsibility in order to use business as a force for good. Join Vicki as she talks about why it's always worthwhile to take care in business. Oh, doing great. How are you?
Are you good? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm good. I am I'm really excited about this interview today because, you know, I feel all the feels when it comes to anything to do with the climate crisis. Mm-hmm. Kind of goes all the way back to, I think, when I can't remember which kid it was, but one of my kids got devastated in, it was either pre-K or kindergarten. About they were learning about the polar bears and they came home and they just were devastated about it. And so it's always like just climate change. And that topic has always been something that is talked openly about in my family. And I think we all are pretty worried about it, you know? So much so that, as you know, Sawyer, Bolson Group, my company, became carbon neutral. Michael, this is something new to last time we spoke, but we became carbon neutral this year, and my household is carbon neutral. But as much as I know that's me doing my part, you know, and feeling good about it, one of my missions is to really try to, in fact, we do pro bono work for Carbon Neutral Indiana here in Indiana. That does the carbon offsets. And I just would like to talk with our guest today, who one is a returning guest, Michael Lennox. He wrote a book. We had him on, it was season 10, episode 74, to talk about his book, How Can Business Save the Earth? So you might remember that. But he has since wrote a book with Rebecca Duff, and it is called The Decarbonization Imperative. And when I was sent the galleys for this, or I guess it's uncorrected page proofs not for sale. So is that the galleys? I don't even know. Anyway, I was sent this version, and I loved that it said transforming the global economy by 2050. And so I was just like, oh my gosh, because I think we all have heard and we all know that, you know, we're in a crisis and we need to do something about it. So I'm so excited that they're here. What I would love is for them to introduce themselves, because I am also interested in how you two got together to write this book and co-author it. And then after you talk a little bit about your background and how you got to working together, I just want to have a conversation about, you know, some of the things that you discuss in the book, you know, some of the highlights, but I want to keep the conversation sort of, even if we talk about an alarming statistic or some data that we're like, oh my word, or like China's doing this and Italy's doing that, you know, whatever, I want to bring it back to how we can have hope from learning that, knowing that data. How can we have hope? What can we do? And what are we responsible for doing, right? So that we can help transform the global economy by 2050. So Michael, I'm gonna let you go first since you're a returning guest.
Sure, well, thank you for having me, Vicki. It's always a pleasure to join you on this podcast. You know, before we talk about everything, I will say, you know, part of this book is about giving hope. And it's partly about how can we get our hands around what can seem like such an overwhelming problem? So we can dive into that. But just to give you a little bit of the roots of this work and how Becky and I came to work together, we started an initiative at the Darden School, where I'm a faculty member at the University of Virginia, probably going about 3 years ago, called Business Innovation and Climate Change. And so the perspective we were taking is to look at what was happening in very specific sectors, things like automobiles and electrical generation, and try to analyze with an eye towards disruption, technological disruption of what was happening. So we looked at where technology stood in terms of its performance. We looked at in terms of new entrants, in terms of competitors and businesses, and really tried to kind of read the tea leaves to see how business innovation was occurring in these different sectors. So that was a series of reports that we did over the last few years. And as we were going through that, you know, Becky and I realized, you know, I think we have a book here. I think there's an opportunity to kind of synthesize all the work we've been doing in the research to bring that together. So it's been an absolute pleasure to have, you know, Becky as a member of the team and to be working closely on this project and now on this book. But Becky, please, you have further introduction.
Sure. So I'm currently a senior researcher at the Batten Institute, which is a center at the Durham School of Business. And, you know, I had this moment. I have many, many years working in energy efficiency and working on environmental issues. And I had this actual moment where I thought, I need to do more. I want to do more. I'm not sure what that is. And I took a break from my 15-year career working on energy efficiency just to explore other opportunities. And a colleague of mine introduced me to Mike and said, hey, here's this brilliant professor who needs work, some support on his book, doing some research. And I said, yes, of course. And so that was Can Business Save the Earth? And we started working together on that book. And then this initiative was launched and I was pulled in to lead that initiative and do this research further. And I think my time, I've been here 4 years now at Darden, and my previous work was supporting the Energy Star products program. And so here I was working in markets, trying to transform markets, different product categories, working with manufacturers and policymakers and others. And, you know, it wasn't until I came to Darden and worked closely with Mike that I truly understood what disruption is and how, based on this research, how this disruption needs to happen across sectors. And I think, you know, my hope is that this book will open people's eyes to just how much work needs to be done to decarbonize across multiple sectors. And so I hope they have the same eye-opening experience that I had when doing my research.
Yeah, no, I know. And it's kind of, this could be considered a really heady topic, right? It's like, you just said it. I hope people realize just how much has to be done, you know? And right. So that's why, you know, some people, you know, I consider myself an empath. So I, you know, really feel and like, but sometimes when it becomes overwhelming when you're an empath and you just want to throw hands and say, forget it, there's nothing I can do. But there are things that we as an individual or we as a business, thus from How Can Business Save the Earth, can do. And so the reason I kind of wanted this to be like a hopeful conversation is like the people who listen to our podcast, I want them to walk away with something they can do. You know, obviously they can go become carbon neutral too. They can, but there's just so much. Just like I was amazed when I took the carbon neutral sort of questionnaire on how they figure out what your output is, and how many offsets you need. I was like, whoa. And so many of my team members were like, I didn't know they were going to ask me if I eat meat. I didn't know if they were going to ask me if I, you know, how often I fly in an airplane. And it's like, well, of course, you know, so I know that's what you mean when you say there's all, you know, there's so many moving parts. So all that to say, could you guys kind of narrow it down to some key takeaways, like things that are less heady for the audience?
So let me see if I can take a first crack at this. Okay. So what we talk about in the book and the way we structure the book is around five sectors that are the primary emitting sectors. So one way to simplify the world is to think about where do emissions actually occur rather than thinking about kind of supply chains and the like. So the first one, of course, that gets a lot of attention is electrical generation. So the use typically of coal or natural gas to produce electricity. The second, that's about a quarter of all emissions. The second, also not surprising, is transportation. Transportation is one of the largest in the United States, automobiles, use of gasoline. Actually, globally, it's only about 20%. So it's a big piece, but you know, not a huge piece of the puzzle, but it's an important piece. The third one that probably gets less attention is what we call industrials. So this is manufacturing, a whole set of technologies like steel and cement that are significant greenhouse gas emitters in the production process itself of making those products. Petrochemicals is another one, the use of plastics and the like. The fourth one we talk about is our built environment, our buildings. We still use quite a bit of like natural gas, for example, to heat buildings, and we use it also for cooking and the like. That's only, I think, remember, around 6% or so. And then last but not least, and maybe the one that's most surprising to people, is about a quarter of global emissions come from agriculture. And that's primarily the growing or use of livestock on the production of methane in a variety of different ways, including cows belching. That is a significant issue. And then also the use of fertilizers, which produces nitric oxide, which is a potent greenhouse gas in the ways in which our soil utilization is used. And so when we think about the decarbonization challenge, what we're in essence talking about is having to drive each one of these five sectors to net zero. So as we said, it's a tall order, but there is some hope. Mm-hmm. Becky, do you want to jump in? I don't know if you want to talk about which ones do you have the most hope for, Becky?
You know, the most hope. So I think, when we think about levers or actions that can be done by consumers, policymakers, and others, I think you have to look at each industry individually. Each of those industries are at different points of commercialization, adoption, et cetera. And so I think the one message we want to get across is there is no single bullet, silver bullet. There isn't even a silver bullet within each industry. And there isn't a single stakeholder that can make the change that needs to be made. I think it all has to happen. And I personally have been thinking a lot about the consumer angle. Out of all the industries, the most fascinating one to me is agriculture. And, this is an industry that has a rich history of consumers really changing the landscape of food made available. If you look at alternative milks, for example, 10 years ago, I myself was looking for an alternative, very hard to find. I think soy was the only one available. Today, I would say about 25% of the milk cabinet or aisle, if you will, is alternative milks. Now there's 10 million alternative milks, and now you have to go through all of those alternatives to see what you like. But I'd say that's encouraging, but it also took 10 years, right? And so how do you accelerate that shift within certain industries? And I guess I would challenge consumers. I know it feels like I'm one person, what can I do? How can I make change? But the whole reason that the agriculture industry went away from treating whole herds with antibiotics and instead, using smarter farming, precision farming to treat animals is because consumers demanded it. And so I think where there is a strong demand, there can be a shift. So I guess I would challenge listeners, think like a consumer, try new alternatives. And it may not, you may try one alternative. Like I tried bamboo paper towels the other day, and it's just not cutting it in terms of performance, right? So my ask to manufacturers would say, okay, put green products out, but make sure that it performs the same or better as the one that it's trying to replace. But I think as a consumer, asking questions about where your food comes, asking questions about where your products come, paying attention to the ingredients, trying new alternatives, because I think you'll be pleasantly surprised that, you know, some of these alternatives are meeting the flavor palette that you're looking for.
That's so interesting. You know, I'm on social media. I have Instagram. It's not that I'm obsessed with it, but they're obsessed with me, because I tell you what, I get almost every single served piece of information I get on social, specifically Instagram, is alternatives. Alternative, you know, food coverings instead of using plastic bags, you know, which I'll give you a suggestion. Instead of the bamboo, just get more cloths and use them and wash them over and over.
Oh, I've heard about Swedish towels.
Yes, the Swedish towels.
Dish towels. Yes, yeah. That's my next try.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, it's more work because you have to do the laundry more and whatever. And so then you got to think about your detergent, you know, I mean, it's just like, but the fact that I'm being served all this, one, it shows me that, you know, that in my industry and advertising and marketing, it works. but also that the demand is there. Like you said, I mean, there are so many alternatives. I mean, the whole, like you said, oat milk, cashew milk, you know, there's a gazillion. And so what about you, Michael? Do you have something that you would suggest is something that we can easily do?
Well, you know, I think one of the premises of the whole book is this notion that, you know, love or hate them, you know, markets could be quite powerful for bringing new products to market and diffusing them quickly when the economics are favorable. And so there are certain sectors that we talk about, like transportation, that I'm relatively bullish on what's happening in terms of electrification of vehicles. Now to say, you know, go out and run, you know, go purchase an electric vehicle is maybe not within everybody's means, but what is exciting that's happened there is the costs are coming down significantly. And so, you know, it is not unreasonable to believe that in the next few years, first of all, we're going to see literally dozens of new models are coming on available from all the major auto manufacturers. And of course, companies like Tesla in the next, you know, 12 months or so, even we're seeing many, many new opportunities come, but the prices are coming down to a point where, you know, I could argue that electric vehicles are going to be favored over internal combustion engines just on their current degrees of merit. You don't have to even worry about or think about climate change. You just might want these more as a reason. And that's where markets can be quite powerful. So that's one where I'm feeling relatively hopeful that it's going to happen. Not to say that policy doesn't play a role, because it can obviously help accelerate that transition. But it's one where they're, you know, it's kind of happening. As we've talked about, I think agriculture is the one I worry about the most as well. It's a very diffuse industry. There are literally millions of farmers around the world, everything from large industrial farms to individual farmers and individual families. There is no, you know, technological solution, as Becky was saying. And a lot of it does rely on consumer preferences. And you know, probably one of the best things we could all do is to, you know, reduce or eliminate our meat consumption. I've reduced mine quite a bit, but I am not at zero, and I think that's true of a lot of people. And so how do you bring about that type of change? Are there technological substitutes? You're starting to see plant-based substitutes for hamburgers and the like the Impossible Burger. Will they get to a point that they become, you know, the primary source of protein, you know, remains to be seen. But that, you know, that in of itself can do a lot from an individual standpoint. It's just cut back on your meat consumption.
Yeah, and I think I would just add that I think the other challenge is this is a global issue, right? And so, you know, we sitting here in a developed country can talk about alternatives and Impossible Burger and all these neat new things, but the reality is in other countries that are growing much more quickly than us, developing countries, increasing economics, if you will, usually means increasing consumption of beef and dairy. And they're not necessarily going to have an interest or access to alternatives. So it's going to continue to be a challenge.
And I would say even here in the U.S., if you think about, you know, it's one thing to wring your hands and say everybody should shop at Whole Foods and buy organic, but it's expensive. And there's a reason that most Americans don't have the privilege to be able to routinely afford to go shop at Whole Foods. And so, again, you know, ultimately, if we want these green goods, these environmentally preferable goods to diffuse, we've got to get them to a price point and a cost point that the average consumer is more than willing to, you know, willing to adopt them.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're not going to be an all vegan electric car driving world, you know? So what, and you mentioned policy, is it even possible? And it's because I haven't finished the book, and maybe you touch on this in the final chapters. Is it even possible by 2050?
Well, you know, I don't, I'm an optimist by nature, so I don't want to say impossible. It's going to be incredibly challenging. With that said, you know, I think what we're trying to outline in the book and what we do get to in the last chapter is the idea of a comprehensive technology policy for the US, but for other countries as well. We need to continue to push along these disruptive alternatives that are you know, more green and more sustainable. Again, I think there are sectors where there is a viable path forward. I think, again, automobiles and electrification with the EVs, in electrical generation, you know, renewables, there's some real technical challenges there around intermittency. The sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, but there are paths forward that people see of how we could address those. Some of these other sectors are going to be tough, and policy can play any number of different roles. It can help, you know, fund R&D, basic R&D that might then, you know, come up with the alternatives we need. It can clearly add juice to markets as new technologies are emerging. You know, if you think about the subsidies for electric vehicles that have existed, and in some cases, we're probably going to require regulation. You think about something like carbon capture and storage, which is talked quite a bit about. You know, from my perspective, that's not a technology that markets will naturally take up, because almost in every case, it's an additional expense to what you're currently doing. So to produce some greenhouse gases, then capture them and do something with them, that's going to be more expensive than not addressing it. So unless you put a price on carbon or put some regulatory apparatus in place, we're not going to see the markets naturally take that up themselves. So again, you know, I think one of our clear messages is we don't need to have one size fits all. What we need to do is be very specific. Like, how are we going to decarbonize cement, right? And there are efforts to work on green cement that not only eliminates the production of greenhouse gases, but actually could be a carbon sink by absorbing carbon dioxide as the cement cures, right?
Yeah.
And again, you know, we can go, and what we do in essence in the book is go kind of sector by sector here in different markets to try to understand what kind of pushes do we need in each of these to make progress.
That really does make sense. And that makes it seem less impossible. I mean, it makes it seem like, okay, if we really, we have these people focusing on this and this, but then there's got to be a collaboration that takes place, right? Mm-hmm. In a communication sharing, I guess. And I don't even really know what I'm trying to say. I guess what I'm trying to say is we need the government tuned in, you know, because you think about things like, you know, and I am no researcher or writer about this, so I apologize in advance for kind of my simplistic way of looking at it, but I worry about, as some of these things change, that there are going to be all these people who are out of jobs, you know, that because that kind of stuff is happening now, right? You know, like we become more automated, you know, with you know, certain jobs, and then a whole industry and a whole really sort of like psychographic of people are out of a job because either that industry is closing down or changing significantly, or they're too old now to be rehired because their industry or their education is in this area. So what about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great, you know, point to make and ask. I do think some of the hand-wringing and worries about reductions in economic growth and unemployment are somewhat misplaced. Take, for example, the coal industry. There's about 50,000 coal jobs in the United States right now. When Blockbuster Video went bankrupt, about 100,000 jobs were lost from Blockbuster Video alone. Now, what's the difference between these two, and why are we wringing our hands about one and seemingly didn't care about the other? Well, Blockbuster was clearly diffused, you know, employment across the country. You know, individuals lost their jobs, but it didn't have the, you know, narrow economic impact that coal has in places like West Virginia, where you have a concentrated industry. What we do know, if you look at economic history, is these types of disruptions happen all the time. We constantly are having new technologies, new industries emerge, old industries fall by the wayside. It doesn't lessen the burden and doesn't lessen the impact on those communities that find themselves in old line industries. But again, this is part of what actually makes market systems so powerful, is that it does constantly invent and renew. You know, there was a time where Nantucket was the center of the, you know, whaling industry. You know, I'm pretty sure all those jobs are gone, right? They've been gone for a long time there. We adjust, we move forward. What I do think it's important is that as we talk about these transitions, we do have to keep in mind that individual human impact, especially on specific communities. We did an effort a few years ago. We did a symposium, a conference where we brought together some leading thinkers in this space. And one of the things that came out of that was the idea of job retraining and trying to refocus communities that are kind of losers as these technologies change to create new opportunities for them. And I think that's an important piece of this. And it plays out obviously in the politics as well, because again, there are likely to be winners and losers in different regions of the United States, for example, depending on which technology advances. But I think that the general sense that, oh, this is going to be a job killer is very, you know, misplaced. You know, throw out one more number, you know, there's something like 400,000 or 500,000 jobs in solar right now in the United States. So, I mean, that industry far outstrips some of these fossil fuel industries that people are worried about job loss in. Again, that's what markets do. They create anew and can be disruptive for those individuals. But again, that's not a news story. That's a story as old as markets.
Yeah, that's super true. Do you think that we're keeping up with, you know, the education of getting generations ready for these new types of jobs? Because, you know, I have kids in college, one out of college, one in, one going, you know, and depending on what they study, are they going to be up to speed, you know, with what is happening in the world?
It's interesting, you know, one of my other areas of interest, and Becky shares this as well, is around digitization and what's happening with artificial intelligence and the like. I think I worry far more about those sectors and those technologies than I do about clean technology at this point, in terms of some of that job displacement. These are somewhat interrelated, though, one could imagine. I think, you know, what's fascinating about the kind of clean tech space is you have a lot of interest, a lot of investment, partly being driven by the climate crisis itself. And I think we will continue to see that over the next few decades. So I think you're right. You know, that's kind of seeing the future and trying to then position yourself for where those jobs are going to be. There's a whole, you know, getting back to agriculture, there's a whole emerging area of ag tech, which is fascinating, which is leveraging everything from drones to other pieces of information technology to increase the efficiency of agriculture. You know, the old days of, you know, the farmer riding his or her tractor across the field, you know, now it's probably going to be an autonomous vehicle that's linked to GPS that is, you know, micro dosing the ground with water and fertilizer for the particular need there. So you might need an advanced degree to be a farmer if you don't need it already, moving forward. You know, again, this is how markets change and how job functions change as a result.
So the book is actually out now, right? Did it come out in early summer? Is that correct? Because I just had
October 19th.
Wow. Okay. So it was delayed because I think that I had heard early summer, but it's coming out October 19th.
That is correct.
And how
order, can you know, people... available for order on Amazon right now, though.
Okay. That is so great. Okay. I want to ask you, Rebecca, before we close. So you said that you wanted to do something different. You started doing this research with Michael. What's going to be next for you? You know, you had the shift. Are you shifting into something that you know what it is now?
So to be transparent, my background is in environmental science, climate change. I mean, that is what my undergraduate and graduate degrees are in. So, you know, this is different, but not that different from what I've devoted my whole life to and my career to. You know, and funny you should ask, I'm going to be continuing to work on sustainability issues here at Darden and find more opportunities to, you know, educate MBAs about sustainability and the importance of considering sustainability no matter what career path you go down. And also look for more ways to get our book and other research around sustainability out. But Mike and I are also kicking off a brand new initiative that is around AI and kind of the benefits and the challenges and the promise and the peril of AI. And my hope is that, you know, we can also weave sustainability into that, because as Mike said, I think it across these industries, AI and digital technologies are going to be critical for getting information and data to people so that they can make good choices and operate sustainably. So every new project I come across, I try to find a sustainable angle to put in there. So I'll be continuing to do that.
Awesome. Well, you guys are two smarty pants. That's for sure. I mean, just literally. But the good news is that the book is very digestible, you know, and like you said, Michael, it does offer, you know, hope, which is something that's important. I think when people feel overwhelmed, like I'm not going to be able to make a difference or, you know, I mean, I think it's going to take the, you know, a village or all of us doing something. And I think for those that are already, this is what I've taken from this. And I wanted you to tell me if I should look at this differently. Okay, I'm carbon neutral. My household's carbon neutral, the company and my household. But instead of just offsetting my carbon output, now I can dig deeper into the things I can do not to have an output. And so I want to, you know, consider getting an electric car. I want to, you know, things like that. Is that the best outlook I should have? Is that the outlook I should have? Or should I be doing something else to make a difference?
I guess, you know, if you think about the broader set of stakeholders that are going to be needed to influence this, and it kind of goes back to, you know, Can Business Save the Earth book. It is policymakers for sure, but it's also businesses, it's universities, it's individual consumers, it's individuals as citizens. You know, one of the powerful things that citizens can do is you know, fight for and request policies that help advance the technologies and the like. That can, you know, just having that voice in the political arena can be a huge help to bring things along. And so I think, yes, I mean, it's your own footprint. It's the way you live your life, but it can go so far beyond that in terms of, you know, trying to bring these changes about. And, to me, you know, again, it's to put the hopeful spin on it again, this perspective of thinking of industry transitions and disruptions and new technologies is really a way of understanding that there is a possible path forward. This isn't impossible. And in fact, you know, in a number of these sectors, again, we have technological solutions that are becoming more market viable every day. And that drastically lowers the political resistance and other resistance to having these technologies in our marketplace, in our lives. The real challenge with climate change, I think, is actually time. We're running out of time. I almost wonder, you know, the book is coming out in October. I think we're already dated with the 2050, because, you know, if you look at the latest IPCC report, they're already saying that we might have to reduce to net zero even before that. And that, you know, just raises the stakes even further. But again, I'm an optimist. I think you have to try. We have to try.
Oh, yeah.
And even if we fail at net zero, at least if we can abate some of the growth in our carbon emissions, that's going to help at some level. That we need, you know, as we say, really a transformation of our global economy. But it's possible. It's possible. And so we got to do it. We got to try.
And I would say, you know, in the age of social media, we're all influencers to some degree, right? And we're all consumers. And so, great that you're carbon neutral. Clap for that, because that's amazing, because not many people can claim that. But really using your purchasing power as a consumer or as a business, using your purchasing power to help transform markets. And then when you make those purchases, share it with others and get the word out, because that can also help accelerate things. So again, I go back to, you know, the consumer, as we're all consumers and we can have a real influence on markets. And so just looking at things when you're purchasing things or making it as a business or consumer, looking at things through a sustainability lens, as opposed to treating sustainability as something outside of that decision-making process.
You just gave me a whole idea for a campaign for the podcast.
Great.
Yeah, I'll have to tell you offline what it is. You're right. We are. Even if you know, you're not an influencer, you're an influencer, and you're right. Yeah. And it is, it's just spreading the word. And that's one of the things with carbon neutral here in Indiana that, you know, we're doing is just trying to educate people, you know, the awareness that, and I was surprised that it doesn't cost nearly as much money as I thought it was going to cost. I mean, I would love to see becoming carbon neutral become just like your utilities that you have to pay to keep the lights on and the trash being picked up. I mean, like, it's a requirement. You're a carbon neutral household and here's how you do it. You know, I think imagine if that were a requirement, how much more quickly people would start doing the other things that are required to be net zero by 2050. So I don't know. I'm really passionate about this topic. I loved talking with you guys. I like the book. I am going to, if you guys want, now that it's coming out in October, I think we can do a couple giveaways on our social media and get people, let's spread the word. Let's get people reading.
That'd be great.
Available on Amazon. Do you guys have any other information you want to give out to the listeners about how they can reach out to you as individuals or about any of your upcoming research projects?
Well, you're easy to find, Mike. So the Business Innovation and Climate Change Initiative that we talked about earlier in the podcast has a website.
Oh, great.
It's off the Darden, www.darden.virginia.edu/innovation-climate. And there you will find the research that Mike and I did early on that was turned into the book. And you will also find a page on the book itself.
Awesome.
On that website. Okay. Yep.
I got that.
And our bios are there as well and how to get in contact with us.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming on. Nice to meet you, Rebecca. Thanks for joining me again, Michael. And when you guys have this artificial intelligence, book. Are you doing a book?
Yeah.
Let's come back. Let's talk about that. So
absolutely. I would love that.
Really appreciate it. I think we had gave some great insight to the listeners, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Vicki.
It was fun. Thanks, Vicki.
I just want to thank Sawyer Benj, our producer, and our show sponsors, Selflessly in Charge. If you'd like to nominate someone for Taking Care in Community, you can visit our website, takingcareinbusiness.com, or email us at info@takingcareinbusiness.com. Don't forget to subscribe, follow, or download Taking Care in Business wherever you get your podcasts. If you love Taking Care in Business, give us a 5-star rating and leave a review or share this episode on your social media. We're on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Taking Care in Biz. That's Taking Care in Biz, B-I-Z. If you have questions or comments, you can also email us at info@takingcareinbusiness.com. Thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our sponsors, Selflessly in Charge. And until next time, take care in business.